Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is the UDRP Implementation Review Team call on the 22nd of April, 2014. On the call today, we have Christine Durain, Joe Tang, Matt Schneller. We have apologies from Luke Soufer. And from ICANN staff, we have Caitlin Tebergen, Marika Koning, Barry Cobb, Jennifer Scott, Steve Chan, and Amy Bivens. And I see that Michaela Nalon also just joined the call. I would like to remind everyone that this call is being recorded. So now we can begin. The agenda for the call is to briefly discuss the modified rules that should be appearing on your screen in the Adobe Connect room. And then I would like to discuss implementation timing for registrars and UDRP providers. And if anyone has any other business that they'd like to discuss, we can do so at the end of this call. So the modified rules that you see on your screen, the changes from our last call have been highlighted in yellow. So I wanted to briefly go over those and see if anyone had any additional comments that they'd like to address. So we slightly tweaked the definition of lock in the definitions of the UDRP rules. And so it now says, lock is a set of measures that a registrar applies to a domain name, which prevents at a minimum any modification to the registrant and registrar information by the registrar, but does not affect the resolution of the domain name or the renewal of the domain name. And so I believe a couple of you wrote in agreeing that we should change by the registrar to by the respondent and the registrar. Did anybody want to pipe in about that change, if you agree or disagree?
So I think I sent this originally. This is Matt Schneller. The rationale behind it was sort of the primary goal is to keep the respondent from making tweaks after the lock has been implemented. So that was really the background. That was a useless comment, sorry.
That wasn't useless. Christine's hand is raised. Go ahead, Christine.
Hi, yeah, this is Christine from National Arbitration Forum. I'm just commenting that I do agree that it should be changed to say by the registrant, because the registrar may have other reasons for updating things that I believe were discussed originally in the working group, although for the life of me, I can't remember what those things are. I feel like that was an important thing to some of the registrars. Also, I just wanted to comment and say, Michaela mentions in the chat the lock sentence is missing a means. And Michaela, as I recall from the working group, we are specifically leaving off a means because there were so many different ways the registries or the registrars were going to provide the lock that there was no consensus as to how that should be done, so they were going to take on their own means. We just wanted to specify the outcome and let the different registrars specify their means. But correct me if I'm wrong, but that was what I recalled from our conversation, Michaela.
Joe, I see your hand is raised. Go ahead.
Yes, this is Joe Tang from WIPO. I was just going to pipe in and also agree with the fact that registrant should be included in that definition of lock.
Okay, thank you. So it seems like everyone is in agreement about that. Is there anyone that disagrees with that change?
Or a respondent, I guess, just to be consistent.
Okay. Does anyone object to that change?
Hey, just one side note from the chat room. Michele confirmed that he just means putting the word means after lock. So lock means a set of measures, which I don't think changes anything and is consistent with some of the other formulation of definitions in the list.
Okay. Okay, I think we can move on to the next change, which is in the definition of pendency. So we just added some text at the end of the definition. So now it reads, pendency means the time period from the moment a UDRP complaint has been submitted by the complainant to the UDRP provider to the time the UDRP decision has been implemented or the UDRP complaint has been terminated. Did anyone have any comments about that change? Or is everyone okay with that? I see Matt is typing.
I was just transcribing for Michelle. She was on another call.
Okay. Okay, so I'll move on to the next change, and if Michaela has any comments, we can revisit them. So the next change is to 4A, and we just modified the text a little bit to say the provider shall submit a verification request to the registrar. The verification request will include a request to lock the domain name. And for those of you who were not on the call, on our last call, the reason that was changed is that initially the text had said something about the provider performing a preliminary compliance check to make sure it was a valid complaint. But the providers suggested that we eliminate that text as to not codify that practice so that providers can have some flexibility in how they do their preliminary compliance check. So rather, we just eliminated that step from the rule and just said that the provider shall submit a verification request to the registrar. Did anyone have any comments about that change? Okay, I don't see any hands raised. I didn't make any changes to the definite or the text in 4B, but I noticed there was some back and forth on the list about possibly making a change. And so I think, Matt, you were the one that initiated the conversation. So did you want to talk a little bit about the change that you thought needed to be made there?
Sure. So in the very last sentence of 4B, which reads now, any modifications of the respondent's data following the two business days shall be addressed by the panel. I thought that may be read as though the respondent could simply make modifications, where I thought maybe something like any requests for modifications of the respondent's data following the two business day period shall be addressed by the panel, maybe more accurately fit what was going on with the lock, where the default is there aren't going to be any changes unless, or after the lock has been imposed, unless the panel specifically grants the right to do so.
I see Christine's hand is raised. Go ahead, Christine.
Yeah, and to be exceptionally clear, because I know we talked about this at length in the initial working group, and maybe this addresses some of your concern too, Matt, and maybe it's just because it's not super clear, but the idea isn't that we're going, that there's going to be some cumbersome process in the middle where suddenly we have to have a preliminary panel, like, reviewing anything. It's just the point was, and what we talked about in the actual working group, was that if there's going to be a subsequent change after the case is commenced or after it's pending, then the panel can just take that into account as part of its deliberations and thoughts, and at that point what happens, at least with the forum, is at any point, even now currently, the practice is if the registrant should happen to change midstream because one reason or another, the panel, like, looks at it and says, or if the respondent comes back and says, well, it's not supposed to list so-and-so, it's supposed to list such-and-such as the respondent, in this case the panel already takes into account and reviews and says, oh, yeah, we're going to change the name of the respondent in the decision to reflect the proper respondent or whatever. But it's not like an interim, like, sort of extra step. It's just when the panel gets to the case, if anybody wants to start to make arguments about so-and-so shouldn't really be named the respondent, so-and-so should be named the respondent, at that point the panel has a chance to amend the decision to name somebody else. And so I just wanted to clarify that that's the practice, and that was sort of what we were trying to get at in 4B. Does that help at all?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't have a problem with the way the panel can address things at the back end. Just the way the last sentence is phrased seems to imply that the respondent's data can be changed after the lock has been applied.
Yeah, what if we changed, and this one's going to throw this idea out to the group, what if we changed that sentence to say any modification of the respondent's data following 2 business day period may be addressed by the panel in its decision? Which is, to my recollection, again, anyone can correct me if I'm wrong, I'm not perfect, which is, to my recollection, what we actually decided.
Marika, I see your hand is raised. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. I actually posted in the chat the language from the final report, which I believe confirms the point that Christine made, that it's really indeed up to the provider, it's at their discretion whether or not the complaint is updated or any other information. But I think it also clarifies that, indeed, if there is an affiliated proxy or privacy service that the registrar is aware of, it may, and if it's indeed the terms and service of that service, to reveal underlying information in the case of a UDRP complaint, this may happen, but it needs to happen before the 2 days before the lock is applied. And I think there's further information as well, talking, because I do recall as well, we discussed extensively as well the potential updating or not, or requirement to do so as part of the working group deliberation. So I'm sure there are other references in the final report that I could dig out if necessary. But hopefully I think this part of one of the recommendations already confirms as well, I think, what Christine already said, and I think some of the feedback I've provided as well on the mailing list.
Thank you, Marika. So does everyone agree with Christine's proposed change, which is for McKaylee, who has just joined, the last sentence of 4B, where it says any modifications of the respondent's data following the 2 business day period should be addressed by the panel, to be changed to any modifications of the respondent's data following the 2 business day period may be addressed by the panel in its decision.
So I think that sentence is perfectly clear. I just don't think it's consistent with the sentence that's right before it. The sentence before it says any changes, such as privacy or proxy, or really whatever changes, have to be made in those 2 business days before there's a lock. And then the next sentence says any modifications following the 2 business days shall be addressed by the panel. But once the lock is applied, you can't modify. I just don't follow how a modification is being made after the lock has been applied.
Christine?
To weigh in, because my memory is so rusty. But I feel like this was like the registrars had come up with a scenario in which they could have locked the domain name and provided the information or whatever, but that their privacy or proxy service in association with a reseller or some other third party might still be getting back to them. And so there might be some quasi-legitimate means. And I agree with you, Matt, that kind of seems, conflicting or contradictory, but maybe the registrar on the call can weigh in, but I believe that there was some scenario in which there was still some sort of a possible update, again having to do with the fact that also I'm recalling a discussion about when the registrant updates their information to the panel, so there was that option as well. So maybe one of the registrars remember, but this was a part of the conversation as to how that ended up like that. I don't think it was an accident.
So there's the updating your information as a respondent after a UDRP has been filed is certainly something that the party can do as a matter of keeping their contact information up to date for the provider, which is, I think, a slightly different issue than changing the respondent data, which is in WHOIS, which would be subject to the lock. Because I just, so I totally agree that there's the privacy proxy stuff we made before the, yeah, I mean, it looks like, because the previous sentence just says, you know, must be made for 2 business days.
Michaeli, did you want to weigh in? I saw your hand was raised.
Thanks. I normally would. I'm trying to remember why what the criteria was. I'm just thinking about this kind of logically. If I, as a registrar, put a domain into a state whereby the registrant can't make changes or transfer to a third, to another registrar, that's fine. But as the registrar, I would still have the ability to make changes, technically speaking anyway, and the registry would still have the ability to make changes. The only person who wouldn't would be the registrant. I'm not sure, to be honest with you. I, there's probably a reason for it, and maybe, unfortunately, you know, we don't deal with many UDRP cases, so I really don't have the experience in this area to give you anything really helpful. I don't know if Luke or Volker or somebody else was on the call, they would probably have a better idea, so I'll shut up.
Thanks, Michaeli. Christine, go ahead.
Thanks. This is Christine from NAF. So I'm dusting off a rusty memory about the difference between the change of a registrant or registrar and simple updating WHOIS contact information. And I believe that there was a disagreement as to whether, if there was an underlying privacy proxy service, if simply releasing the privacy shield in the WHOIS qualified as a registrant change. Anybody else recall a conversation to that effect? Is that what this is about? Was that the lock is still there, you can't change the quote-unquote registrant, but presuming that they're just showing the beneficial owner, that was not a registrant? Anybody? Bueller?
This is Michaeli. I have a vague recollection of this conversation. So I suppose the thing is this. Okay, let's say for argument's sake, let's say that as the registrar of record of a domain, I get the email from NAF or WIPO or whatever, and I send whatever data there is. But let's just say maybe the registrant has put our contact details into WHOIS. Of course, I can update that then and there, can't I? I'm trying to remember, and it's been so long.
Yeah, and this really does have to do with a privacy or proxy service that's not connected to the registrar. I know that for a fact. That was the situation. It was because where you have the privacy proxy service connected to the registrar, it's not an issue.
Yeah, I can imagine that. If anybody can remember who raised this, I know it wasn't me. I mean, that's all I do know, that for once it's not my fault. But it's probably, I think it's one of these ones where it was a very good example of a real scenario. Maybe Marika remembers. She's very good at remembering things.
Yeah, and I feel like it might have been Volker. Marika?
This is Rick. I'm still trying to actually get my head around what the actual question is. So we're talking about here what happens if the privacy proxy service is not linked to the registrar, whether that information can be revealed or not. Or whether that, if that change is made, whether that's considered a change of registrant. And my recollection is that I think the working group acknowledged that we're currently not in an environment where we have accredited privacy proxy services, so it's not possible to know for sure whether you're dealing with a privacy proxy service, and you know maybe someone actually asking for a change of registrant name. I think the working group's still on really allowing this pre-reveal for privacy proxy information by affiliated registrars, affiliated services with registrars, and leave any other update to the discretion of the provider and have that dealt with as part of the privacy proxy accreditation working group. I believe that's where, at least I recall, it landing. And I'm looking through the report because I think there's some other references. But is that the specific question we're focusing on, or is there anything else I need to look at?
I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Matt, this is Caitlin, that the question kind of arose because in that last sentence when it says any modification of the respondent's data, I think Matt was suggesting that instead of having any modification of the respondent's data to any request for modification of the respondent's data, because presuming that the name has been locked, there shouldn't be any modifications following that lock, and so it would be a request for a change of the respondent's data at that point.
I think you recall that I seem to recall that it wasn't necessarily a privacy proxy issue. It was more like, hey, my phone number changed, and let me pass that along. Even though the lock is there, you know, sort of put it into the record that this is a change, and then the change will be implemented as soon as will sort of be put in queue to be considered by the panel, keep their information up to date, and then the change will be implemented as soon as the UDRP is resolved or terminated or settled or whatever the resolution is.
And this is Marika. I think I may have found the relevant section there in our report that talks about this. It basically says any changes to WHOIS information during dependency of the administrative proceeding under the policy may be permitted or prohibited based on the registrar's applicable policy and contract. However, it is the responsibility of the registrant to inform the provider of any relevant updates that may affect provider notices and obligations to respondent under the UDRP. And to add to that, as I understood it as well, I believe from the conversation of the working group, I think Christina always reminded us, any changes to WHOIS after complaint has been initiated and the data from WHOIS has been taken is irrelevant, because basically whatever information was there at the time the lock is applied, that is what goes into the complaint. The provider doesn't go back after the fact and looks at WHOIS information to see if a phone number or anything has been changed. So again, it's up the responsibility of the respondent, possibly via the registrar, to communicate that. And I'm sure Christine can correct me if I'm wrong, but that was my understanding of our conversations during the working group, that the only thing that matters is at the time of the lock, what is the information in WHOIS, any updates after the fact don't really matter, although, of course, information should be up to date and correct so that notices are received, because I think that is the conversation we did have. You know, what if a registrant comes back and says, well, actually, you know, my email address is wrong and now I'm not receiving any notices. You know, how is that handled? So I think the working group said those updates can be made provided that's permitted by the registrar, but it doesn't necessarily affect the complaint, and those communications do need to be made separately to the panel to ensure that they have that information as well.
Yeah, to the extent that, this is Christine from F, to the extent that any respondent, whether it's a proxy service or not, comes forward with updated contact information, I mean, certainly the forum, I'm not sure WIPO handles it, but certainly the forum will update its records to make sure that the most accurate information is provided. But we're not going to keep forcing the complainant to go back and amend and following the bouncing ball along, you know, as things change. So, you know, it's like once we get the lock, once we get confirmation from the registrar, we proceed and go forward. We might serve an additional, party. The panel might change the party name in the decision. But at some point, the buck has to stop, and we have to proceed with the complaint. Otherwise, we'll be, you know, changing contact information for a month.
Thanks, Christine. Joe, I see your hand is raised.
Yep. I'd just like to pop in with the whole thing about the lock is in. Yes, that if further details do arise after the complaint's been filed, whether the privacy shield's been lifted or even if the lock's been applied, and then afterwards, details of the respondent comes forth, we will inform the panel. We will include it in the details for all our communications. And if changes do happen to the HUI status after a lock has been applied, we will, as much as possible, keep note of it. We might ask the registrar to just say that we've noticed that this has changed. Can he tell us why this is so? And if it's something as simple as that a privacy shield has been removed, then that's fairly obvious why it's been changed, and we will change the details over here to amend that and make sure that we have all the communication details to make sure notices are sent out properly. If it's something to the extent of like an entire registrar has changed or an entire detail about the registrar, about the respondent's change, then that's more of an issue. But revealing details, if it's before the lock has been applied, we may go back to the complaint and say, by the way, we've noticed that this information has come forth. You may like to amend the complaint. But even if it happens after a lock has been applied, we can put it into our communications, for example, and ensure that the panel is informed of it.
Thank you, Joe. So I'll ask again if the group is okay with the text that Christine had proposed, or if we need to revisit this after the following this discussion. But any modifications of the respondent's data following the 2 business day period may be addressed by the panel in its decision, changing shall to may. Marika, go ahead.
This is Marika. I'm wondering if it may be helpful, or maybe that is something that would be covered in an FAQ linked to this document, where indeed it is explained that any updates to contact information can or may be made depending on the registrar requirements, and noting as well that this may be necessary indeed to receive notifications or updates. So maybe it is something that we do need to capture somewhere. I'm not sure if it's indeed this is the right document, but if there is going to be an FAQ, that may be the kind of information. And again, I think that the part I quoted there, or I don't know if I put in the chat, but I can refer you to the final report, may be a way of explaining to those implementing this or involved or affected by this, what they can and can do, and what those modifications are referring to.
And just to jump in quick, it's in, if you look down to 4G, it does say that respondents make corrections, and the actual RP rules in the place where it talks about what the response needs to include also says the respondent can update their contact details. So there's a lot of basis for that.
Thanks, Christine. Michaeli, your hand is raised. Go ahead.
Thanks. Yeah, just this is kind of not directly related to exactly what we're talking about here, but it kind of is indirectly. And this I'm going to throw directly at the registrar liaison team, or I think you've been renamed to something else recently as part of the ICANN 2.0. I think you're now the registrar, I don't know what the hell it is, something different anyway. One of the things that is a problem from a registrar perspective if you're only dealing with small volumes of UDRPs is when you get one, you kind of end up looking at it, scratching your head and going, right, what the hell do I do? And when you ask ICANN, they go, oh, well, it's Registrar Services Team. Thank you. I knew you'd been renamed to something. But one of the problems is that unless you're dealing with large volumes and having inside counsel and have experience, et cetera, it's a bit of a catch-22. So what I would ask you to do if, and this is, as I say, it's for the Registrar Services Team, I'll try to remember that, is please provide clear, simple English instructions for pointing registrars in the right direction of what they're meant to do. Because to be perfectly honest, when we got the first UDRP, I ended up having to call a friend, and I'm just lucky enough that I happen to be friends with some of the people who handle large volumes of UDRPs. Otherwise, we'd have been completely screwed. Thanks.
Thanks, Michaeli, and we'll definitely take note of that request when we're developing educational materials like FAQs and webinars and trying to make them very clear and concise so that any registrar that doesn't handle large volumes of UDRP complaints will know what they're supposed to do when they do receive one.
Thanks. Yes, I think a lot of the issues around I mean, not all, but I think a lot of issues that a lot of us run into around UDRPs is simply, if I get one UDRP every 6 months, it's not normal. Now, if you ask me about, updating WordPress to the latest version, most of my staff know how to do it. But, you know, with something like a UDRP, we haven't got a clue. Thanks.
Thank you, Michele. Did anyone else have any comments on 4B before we move on to the next change? I don't see any hands raised, so I will go ahead and move on to the next change. But if you do think of something, please feel free to raise your hand or put something into the chat. So the next changes are in Section 17 of the UDRP rules. And so for 17.6, we change the text a little bit to say that the complainant shall confirm to the provider that the settlement has been implemented further to the provider's supplemental rules. And so we wanted to give providers a little bit of leeway in terms of how many days they wanted to give complainants to notify the provider of the settlement, only because that would allow them to have more leniency. Does that language capture our discussion during the last call? Christine or Joe, do you have any comments on that?
Yeah, this is Joe. Just with regards to those extra wording, further to the provider supplemental rules about giving us some leeway to do so, is it necessary to specify that it has to be to our rules at all?
I think that would be in the provider's discretion. And I see that Christine wrote that she's comfortable with this. Matt is typing, so I'll let him finish typing.
It's unimportant.
Oh, okay. So, Joe, are you okay with that wording? Provided that the UDRP provider has discretion to have some sort of time limitation or not a time limitation at all?
No, as long as they have discretion, that's fine. I'm just querying whether or not we need to say that time explicitly.
Yeah, okay. Joe, do you prefer the word further to any provider supplemental rules?
Sorry, just repeat that bit. Any provider supplemental rules.
Yeah, instead of the, if you change the to any provider supplemental rules, do you, and then you'd have to change providers to provider. But any provider supplemental rules would assume then that where a provider has supplemental rules around the procedure, then great. But if they don't, well, then that's fine too.
No, I think we'll keep it with the, because if you go with one provider, you just pretty much stick with the procedure that's they're using, and it would be up to the discretion of us or you to specify the details of that. I mean, I've don't have strong feelings on it either way, just want to raise that question.
Okay, thank you, Joe and Christine. So in 17.7, we changed the language a bit to say the provider will dismiss the proceedings without prejudice unless otherwise stipulated in the settlement. Are the providers okay with that language? I think for those of you who weren't on the last call, I had initially drafted language that said the proceedings would be dismissed without prejudice. And Christine and Joe had come in and said, well, it's completely up to the parties and their settlement. So sometimes it is with prejudice. There's all sorts of permutations of settlements under the UDRP, so we didn't want to lock in that it would have to be without prejudice. Did anyone have any comments on that, or is that completely uncontroversial? Okay, I don't see any hands raised, so I'm assuming that's okay. And that was the last change that was updated since our last call in the modified rule. So did anyone have any comments in general about the changes or things that they saw that we still need to change before we move on to talk about implementation timing?
Sorry, this is Jo Tang from WIPO, just because this might be my memory in terms of needing some refreshment. When we refer to the standard settlement form to the provider for the settlement bid, is that a settlement form to be crafted by the provider, or is that something that we are supposed to put together as this working group and would be part of ICANN and the UDRP rules?
That's a very good question. Christine, I see your hand is raised. Maybe you have an answer.
Well, I have a very rusty recollection that the providers would provide the forms much like they kind of do now for different things. But then I did know that somebody else had suggested that there was a uniform form that all the providers would use. And I don't think that we came to a conclusion on that. So I think my recollection is as rusty as yours, but I was in favor, for the record, of letting the providers have their own forms because that would, you know, be specific to whatever their requirements are.
Yeah, I just raised it because I'm noting in the final report and the recommendation says a party submitted a standardized settlement form and it didn't really indicate who was doing that standardization. I mean, for the record, I'm the same as Christine on this, that I would be more in favor of the providers being able to set out that form, but I thought to raise that question just to make sure we're all clear on it.
Yeah, I think that was, this is Christine from NEV, I think that was to avoid the parties inventing 100 different types of forms themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But that was, again, you know, I think we're all dealing with the same rusty, you know, brains after all this delay.
Would you like to delete the word standard from 17A3? Marika, see your hand is raised. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. The recommendation actually does talk about a standardized form, and I think exactly to Christine's point, this was to avoid having different kind of methods. I looked through the working group report, but I couldn't find anything in relation to, indeed, whether there was agreement or disagreement on who should develop that standardized form. And I don't see anything in the report, and to be honest, I don't recall either that there were either strong views in favor of one approach or another. So I do think it probably needs to say standardized, but I guess maybe I can and the providers can discuss how such a standardized form can be developed. I don't know if that's a reasonable approach.
Marika, this is Christine from NAF. My only concern with that is it doesn't necessarily jive with the 4 or 17A6, which talks about the provider supplemental rules. And I know, you know, while I'm pretty sure that both WIPO and NAF have pretty similar suspension processes, they're not exactly the same. We have different procedures and kind of protocols around them. And while we can uniformly agree to follow 17, there are other sort of little incidental pieces that are different, and then I don't even know about the other two providers. So I'm kind of in favor of allowing the providers to come up with a form that has to be used for that provider. So parties can't just make up any sort of thing and send it in. They have to use the provider form. But I'm not in favor of forcing all four providers, or five or six providers, however many providers there are now, to use the same form. But, I mean, I guess I could be outvoted on that.
Yeah, and this is Rick. I didn't interpret standardized either to mean identical. I think it's more that it has the kind of same layout, and maybe indeed the starting questions are the same, so people see that it follows the process here. But I don't think it was intended to mean that those should be identical. It probably should be standardized, so there's indeed a form at each provider that people can go to that indeed follows these steps and may have indeed additional information or requirements based on the supplemental rules for the provider.
I see Matt propose some text in the chat, which is the parties reach a settlement and provide a standard settlement form provided by the provider to the provider.
That's a lot of provides.
provides and providers in that text, but it does make clear that that would be in the provider's discretion as to what form that they use, rather than having everyone use the same form. Did anyone else have any comments on that?
This is Joe from WIPA. I mean, we could keep the text as it is, because 17A3 would operate with 6 with regards to further to provider supplemental rules, and with the implication that standard form would be from the provider following our supplemental rules, or NAF supplemental rules, insert provider supplemental rules here.
I like that suggestion, Joe. I see that Ty Gray has his hand raised. Go ahead, Ty.
Hello, can you hear me, Caitlin?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. So I apologize, I haven't been on the last few calls, but I'd like to just jump in here with a couple of just observations. I was just noting that when reading this language with regards to settlement, I recall that there are certain obligations perhaps on different parties as to what constitutes what would be required under a particular law for an enforceable settlement. So maybe perhaps when you talk about standard settlement form, maybe it should just be that a form, meaning certain elements would exist in such form. And moreover, looking at 17A4, when it talks about the outcome of the settlement, that also makes me think that, for instance, you don't want to provide the entire settlement agreement to the registrar and the providers, because there might be other things that would be involved in that, which would make me want to come back to the standard settlement form, meaning that some document would be produced that just says certain elements, meaning that the parties agree to a certain outcome or disposition with regards to the domain name only, and leave it flexible so that the parties can choose to hide certain other details about the settlement or comply with whatever other regulations would be applicable in whichever court or jurisdictions that would apply.
Thank you, Ty. Did anyone else have any comments about the settlement language? Okay, I don't see that there are any hands raised, so... Oh, I lied. Matt, go ahead.
I think I'd just say in the chat that the two things that I've been typing, maybe we just put a clarification in, I put 5 and 6, that says further to the provider supplemental rules and settlement forms, where we're specifically calling. It's a less linguistically offensive way of what I was trying to get at in the other provision in 17A. So it would still make clear that the providers are providing some sort of form. And the forms are just for the administrative convenience of the provider. They don't limit the party's ability to enter into a much more detailed contract if they're concerned about enforceability or have other sort of concerns about the settlement agreement.
Thank you, Matt. I see Christine is typing. Okay, and Christine says the registrars wanted this language because they don't want to have to review a variety of settlement agreements. And that makes sense, so that the form would be just an administrative step in the process. So did anyone else have any further comments on settlement before we move on? Okay. Seeing as there are no hands raised, I briefly wanted to discuss implementation timing, and particularly from the UDRP provider and the registrar's point of view. Generally speaking, we've been doing 6-month implementation cycles, which means that once the changes have been announced, the registrars have 6 months for coming into compliance with the new agreement. So, or with the changes to the rules, so that once the changes would be announced, ICANN would start enforcing the changes to the rules or the locking within 2 business days after 6 months. Does that seem reasonable to you, McKaylee, or any other registrars on the call?
Hi, McKaylee, for the record and all that. I think I'm the only registrar on this call, unless there's somebody lurking. I would have to check with my fellow registrars before I made a categoric declaration on their behalf, because the idea of being hung, drawn and quartered, or more technically correctly, hanged, drawn and quartered. I've never understood why hang is hanged, but anyway, I'd need to check with them. I know that a lot of them, I mean, this, you know, I can see this kind of splitting both ways, in that these changes are probably good for us overall. So I can't see people resisting massively, but I'm also very conscious of the fact that most registrars are up to their proverbials trying to implement a very large number of new domain extensions. So I will come back to you on that.
Thank you, McKaylee. And I think that perhaps when we put out the new language for public comment, we can also put out a proposed implementation timeline in that way, that any registrars or contracted parties that are not in the working group could make comments about the reasonableness of the timelines. Did anyone else have any comments about timing or anything for that matter, any other business that they'd like to bring up before we close this call? So I don't see any hands raised or any comments in the chat currently. But the next step should be that I will incorporate the most recent changes that we discussed during this call into the modified UDRP rules, and then we would post them for public comment so that people that weren't, like I said, weren't involved in the working group or the implementation review team could make comments to the updated rules. Marika, did you have any comments maybe about how that generally works? Go ahead, Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. Well, we have had previous instances, but I don't think we've had any public comments really with involvement of an implementation review team or where it has been done in such a way. So I think it will be important as well when we post it for public comment to really make clear that, you know, these changes as proposed have gone through or have been reviewed as well by the implementation review team that was created by the GNSO Council, consisting of members of the working group that developed the policy recommendations, really to make sure that the recommendations would be implemented as intended. And I think as a result as well, the public comment forum should really then focus on the question if there are any comments that, you know, indicate whether or not the proposed implementation is in line with the policy recommendation or not, because I think we want to avoid that this becomes an open comment on whether the UDRP is a good thing, a bad thing, what other things could we fix. To really make sure that we focus or shape it in such a way that that is the focus of the public comment forum. And it, as you said, it could also include indeed proposed input on the timeline for implementation, because it will need to run, the comment forum will need to run through its 21 plus 21 days. And based on the feedback received, you know, depending on if there are any issues that are raised that would need further consideration by the implementation review team in combination with staff, additional calls may be needed, or if indeed there's only support and no concerns, relatively shortly after that, official notification could go out, presumably.
Thank you, Marika. I also just wanted to ask a quick question. I know there were a couple of proposed changes that we talked about during this call, so I was thinking that I would incorporate those into the rules today while it's fresh in everyone's memory and send it out to the list. And for anyone that would like to make comments, including those that were not able to attend this call, you can do so on the list before we put this out for public comment next week. I don't think another implementation review team call is necessary at this point, but I did want to see what the group thought about that. I was thinking that perhaps after we get comments after the public comment period is closed, we can discuss how we want to change the rules, if at all, at that point. But other than that, I don't necessarily see that we need to have another call next week. But if anyone on the call disagrees, please raise your hand or say something in the chat. Okay, seeing as there are no hands raised or no further comments, I propose that we close this call. I wanted to thank everybody for your participation. It's so very much appreciated by ICANN staff. Also, thanks to the ICANN staff members that are on this call. I will be sending out the modified rules later on today so that it's fresh in everyone's memory, so we're not trying to figure out what we had in mind a couple weeks ago. So again, thank you to everyone. I wish you all a good morning, afternoon, or evening, and I look forward to seeing your comments on the listserv. Thanks, everybody.